So we're going to continue our series on Rethink. Had some cool conversations last week as we began to rethink God and how God was both a lot bigger and somehow smaller than we'd ever imagined. Just mind-blowing kinds of things. So had some really, really cool conversations about what it means to rethink God and so to rethink our interaction with Him. We're going to take that further today. We're going to start in Matthew chapter 16, first book of the New Testament. All right, so if you have a Bible, go ahead and turn to the first book of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 16. If you don't have a Bible, we'll put the text up there for you. Matthew chapter 16. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, He asked His disciples, His students, His learners, "Who do people say the Son of Man is? Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" He asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven." It's like, good job, Peter. Simon Peter, good job. This is not something you came up with. This is something God's been trying to tell us all along, and you're picking up on it. Good job. Jesus seems to be very, very interested in how we see Him. He seems to be very interested in how we view Him. And it seems like that's right it's in perfect harmony with what God has always thought. I want people to see me the right way, or all the way back to the third commandment. Don't misrepresent me. Don't misuse my character and my name. Don't attach me to things I'm not attached to. Don't misrepresent me to people. So Jesus is asking, hey, what do people think of me? What are people saying about me? I got to hang out with my grandma last month, which is always a cool thing. And we're sitting and talking about things, and midway through the conversation, she starts rifling through her purse, and she pulls out this tri-folded piece of paper. And she explains to me that somebody just kind of walked up to her out of the middle of nowhere and handed it to her, and it was a tract. It was a piece of paper that said, this is what Jesus wants for you. Here's what it means to become a Christian. And so it said, pray this prayer, and then there was a prayer italicized. And then it said, you're going to want to read the Bible. And then it said, you're going to want to go to a church service somewhere. That was it. Welcome to the team. So I'm looking at it, and I thought, okay. And then I flip it over, and taped to the back of this was a $5 bill. No explanation, no nothing. So I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, okay. God sent His Son to die for you, to die for mankind, and to start a revolution for humanity. So we're going to summarize it with these three bullet points, and here's $5, which is like dying for you, just a little cheaper. And so I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, how did we get here? How in the world did we get here? I'm not saying that the things were evil. It was probably done with a really good heart. I'm just, how did we get here? How did that become what it is? I mean, God is so big and so marvelous, and he's so wonderful according to what we're saying. So if that's true, then why do we have to pay people to think positively about Him? How can that be true? How did we get there? Can His whole movement be summed up by, hey, pray this, read the book, get to a church building this weekend if you can. Here's $5. Is that really? Is that it? How did we get here? If God is so big, in other words, let's just be totally honest. If God is so big, then how is this His end game? Why is this what He wants? If God is so big and so marvelous, why would this be what He wants for people? See, I think people everywhere are learning about Jesus, regardless of where they are right now or where they go through the week and what they believe and what they're faith. Everybody is always learning something about Jesus. And the way that people learn about Jesus is they look at His followers. That's the way it works. You want to know something about Jesus, you can read a little bit, but the thing that's really going to teach you about who Jesus is watch His followers. It doesn't work in reverse. You can't learn about people by watching Jesus. So you learn about Jesus by watching His followers. And so Jesus seems to be very interested in saying, what do people think about me? Who do people say that I am? And he's still asking that question. What do people think that I came to set up? What do people see in me? What's their opinion of me? Who do you say that I am? So what I want to do is we're going to take a couple of side roads here, and then at the end, hopefully, end on something that'll be helpful and challenging. We're going to start in the book of Exodus, second book in your Bible, Genesis, Exodus. So start at the beginning and go to Exodus chapter 12. All right, Exodus chapter 12 is moments before God is going to rescue Israel out from underneath Egyptian slavery. For years and years and years, the Egyptians have been held in captivity by Egyptians, and they're being treated more and more harshly, completely inhumane. And so God sends Moses and Aaron in to say, I want you to get Pharaoh to let my people come out so that they can live the life that I carved out for them. I want them to have the best life possible. And so I want you to lead the people out so that they can worship me and so that they can live the life that I have for them. And so over and over, there's these plagues. There's these things that God does. And each time, it's like, here's things that the Egyptians worship, bugs and beasts and all these different things. And God turns them into plagues as if to say, hey, that's not a god. That's a plague. I made that. And so over and over, it's like God trying to get their attention. This is going to get worse for you. Let my people go. Let them have their life back. And so we come to this moment where this is going to change everything. The last plague is about to happen, where the angel is about to pass over everybody that has the blood on their door and all that. It's a fascinating story, and it starts right here in chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord, and the Lord there in all caps, that means it's Yahweh, so it's God's name. Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. God said, what I'm about to do is so huge, I want you to reset your calendars. I mean, this is where it starts, right here. This changes everything. Get a new calendar, all right? Verse 3, tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. And then he goes on to say, here's how we're going to memorialize this. Every year from here until forever, I want you to remember what's about to happen. God loves pictures. God is very tactile. He loves to give us things that we can hold on to remember, you know, pictures that we can remember bigger truths by. He says, I want you to do, and he explains what to do. I want you to do this every year because I want you to remember how significant this moment is. Now, we need to understand that this is deeply significant to Israel. Most scholars agree that Exodus is where the story begins. Even though the book starts in Genesis, the Jews were defined by the story of Exodus, by God rescuing people out from Egyptian slavery. This is their central story. To the extent that most scholars agree, Genesis was the last book to be written of the first five. To say, well, since here's the Exodus story, let me tell you how we got here. And then that was added on at the end. So this is central to what it means to be a Jew, to be an Israelite, is the story of the Exodus. Verse 3, when he says, tell the whole community of Israel. When you get to the word community, it's the first time this word in Hebrew is used. It's the word edah. Edah is what they are, is a specially called and appointed people. They're not just the assembly. They're not just my people. They're not just the sons of Israel anymore. This is the first time God refers to them on the night of the eve of the Passover that he says they are the Edah. They are a specially appointed people. Now, Edah comes from just a shorter form, Ed, like E-D, Ed. So if your name's Ed, it's like he was talking to me this morning, you know. So an Ed is just a witness. So like in Isaiah 43:10, when God says, you're my witnesses, go tell people what I'm like. Go show forth my glory. Go tell people my significance. Go live this. He says, you are my Ed. So he calls this special assembly of people, you are my Edah. You are a collection of appointed people. You are on a mission. I'm not just going to call you out of slavery, but then you will go put life. You will go pattern that. You will go pattern me. You're going to go tell people what I'm like. You're going to go live the best life possible. It's like you are on a mission to go represent your sender everywhere you go. Everywhere you go, a called, special, appointed people. You're not slaves anymore. You're out from underneath slavery. You're out from underneath death. You're out from underneath oppression. You're out from underneath everything that stands against the will of God, what he wants for human beings. That's gone. But it doesn't stop there. Now I want you to take it further and go show people what real life is all about. It's like God is saying, I am redeeming you, and I'm saving you, and I want you to go take it forward. I want you to go live and tell about this life forever to anybody that will listen, to anybody that will watch. So at one point, God even says to Abraham, look, of all the peoples in the world, I am calling you Hebrews, you Israelites, to go be the salt of the earth, the light of the world. He even says, all the families on the planet are going to be blessed because of you. I am going to rescue the world in compassion and love and goodness, and I'm going to do it through you. You guys are my rescue boat. You are my rescue operation. Amazing, amazing calling. And throughout the scriptures, we find that God, unlike any kinds of religions that we see in that day, strangers, aliens, people nothing like you, if they want to join this, let them join. No questions asked. They're a brother to you. Bring them into the fold. Let them join this movement of restoring what has been taken off the rails. Let them join you. Wherever you find them, let them join you if they want to join you. Whoever they are. It's a rescue mission. It's a rescue mission. Israel is God's plan of rescue. Fascinating. So what we find throughout the scriptures then is God trying to get the people, his Edah, to believe this. They won't hold on to it for any length of time. So over and over again, God is saying, okay, don't forget, you are my special people. You're the light of the world. You're going to be a light to the nations. This is who you are. Don't come off the tracks. Don't forget who you are. But the prophets, so often we see, and the prophecies written in the Old Testament, is God saying, okay, you're blowing it again. And him reminding them of what they were called to be. So it's back and forth throughout the Old Testament. And I love this in Hosea chapter 11. It says this. This is God speaking. He says, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, to false gods, to the Baals. They burned incense to images. They made offerings to things they carved with their own hands. It was I who taught Ephraim, another name for Israel, to walk, taking them by the arms, but they didn't realize it was I who healed them. I led them with the cords of human kindness, with ties of love. I lifted the yoke, the burden, from their neck and bent down to feed them. God is like, I'm nurturing my son. It's like my little boy. But the more I did for them, the more I called him, the more I casted a vision for his life, Israel, the collective people that he refers to as like his little boy. It's like the further they went away. No matter what I do, I can't get them to latch on to what I have for them, to who I want them to be, to what they'll be in this world. They don't get it. They keep turning away. And you know what? Now the rescue boat needs rescuing. The Edah missed it. They've misrepresented life. They're now, rather than the appointed people, now they're part of the problem. And now they need rescued. Back and forth. And you know what? They not only don't get it. This isn't just a courage issue. They're turning from me and worshiping Baal. Now, Baal is the Old Testament fertility god of the Canaanites. He comes up all over the place in the Old Testament. And so Baal was worshipped to bring the rain. You know, a lot of parched land there, so he'll bring the rain. Baal, if you make offerings, you'll have a good harvest. So it's not, they never totally left Yahweh. It's like, God got us out of Egypt, but when the rubber hits the road, we need a God that'll produce corn. And so it's like, and so we hear this terminology in the Old Testament. God saying, I'm like a jealous God. Could you please come back to me and be who I called you to be? Why are you worshipping Baal? Have you forgotten who you are? To worship Baal, you lit incense. And then there was self-mutilation. There were all these strange sex practices that went because it's a fertility cult. You've forgotten who you were. And so Israel is either entering the world and becoming the very thing that they were sent in to redeem. They're becoming the part of the problem. Or they turn and they completely hide from society and have no value. They just become a little boxed in religious community, back and forth. And so back and forth through the Old Testament, if you look at the narrative as a whole, you find that Egypt continues to find itself under captivity again. They're slaves over and over again. It's Egypt, then it's Assyria, then it's Babylon, then it's Rome. Over and over again, God's appointed people missed it. The Edah missed it. Now, What's helpful about this is the backdrop against what Jesus is placed. Jesus doesn't come as like a separate story. Jesus is the culmination of the story. Jesus is the culmination of what Israel was supposed to be. Jesus speaks into the story because he's part of it. So it's against that backdrop that, you know, when you have Jesus telling people, follow me, taking them by the hand, following, you got God teaching people to walk again. Let me show you how to live. Let me show you the best life possible. Let me lovingly guide you into the best life possible, because you guys are missing it. You're completely missing it. Let me show you what this looks like. And then let me redeem you to eternally take you out of bondage to slavery. That's what he did on the cross. He was the new Passover lamb. Let me put the best life possible on display, free the captives, and give you your lives back. So as Jesus walks the earth, people are hearing him say things and watching him do things. They can't take their eyes off of him. They can't stop talking about him. Who is this Jesus? We've never seen anything like this. Religious leaders were a little freaked out. Everybody's going and listening to this guy. And so Jesus is very interested to hear, well, what do people think of me? Let's go back to Matthew chapter 16, where we started. When Jesus, 16:13, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, the prophets. How about you? Simon answered, you are the Messiah, son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my own Father in heaven. You're picking up what the Father is laying down. Very nicely done. Now, I'm going to show you a map here real quick. This is the area that they're in. Up at the top you see Caesarea Philippi. It's 20 or so miles north of where a lot of Jews live. You know, Nazareth, the whole Galilee where Jesus spent a lot of time. This area, when Rome kind of took over the whole world, this Caesarea Philippi, this was a town called Panias at the base of a big mountain. And Herod Philip rebuilt it. It was in a shambles, and he rebuilt it and named it after himself, which is what you do. So if anytime you fix something, just name it after yourself. You've earned the right. That's what you do. So he rebuilds this whole place, but it was before it was called Caesarea Philippi, it was called Panias. Now, to this day, and it's in Arabic, it's called Banias. It got its old name kind of back. What's interesting about this is this town is set at the base of a giant rock, a giant, like a mountain. It goes 100 feet straight up. It's about 500 feet wide. This is called Baal Hermon. This is the Old Testament worship site for Baal, the fertility god. This is where it happened. This is where the magic happened, in that area right there. All right? Now, what happened through time is Baal worship gave way to Greek fertility cults. They began to worship other fertility gods. So we went from this fertility god to, you know, when the Greek era kind of came in, they kind of took over and had a new fertility god. And so Panias is the center for worshiping Pan. Many of you have heard of Pan or you've seen Pan. He's the goat boy. Half goat, half man, and then cute little horns. Really, a lot of Christian imagery that talks about Satan. This is the imagery that they use. They use Pan. It's an ancient tradition of doing that. But this is Pan. Pan is a huge, huge emphasis in this area. He's worshipped. He's the fertility god. He's the god of fright. And the legend goes that when he was born, his mother saw him and freaked out, like you would. And so that's where we get our word panic. From Pan. He's the god of fright, but he's the god of fertility. You make offerings to Pan. Pan goes down into the abyss, and he comes back every spring and brings life back. He goes down in the winter, and then he brings life back in the spring. And so people hoarded around this area to worship Pan. Now, it's interesting the way that they worshiped him. There's these little niches carved out in the rock here, this Baal Hermon. These little window things were carved out because people would go and they'd place these statues of Pan. So all these little idols and all these little offerings to Pan that were kind of, you know, things that you make with your hands, these go in these little windows. If you made really big contributions to the faith, they'd etch your name in there, you know, like the first century equivalent of a park bench in dedication to. So, yeah, so this whole wall is full of these little, you know, some of them are real elaborate window-looking ones, others just little holes, and it's full of all these little idols. All right, so now what? There's another interesting component, because when you're worshiping Pan, there's all these different, you light incense, there's song, there's ecstatic utterings where you're saying things that nobody knows what you're saying, and there's people flying around and crazy music and stuff. It, really, all this really nutty stuff going on, but it's a fertility cult. And so there are sacred sex rites. on certain nights, bestiality was part of how you worshipped Pan. And just this thing that was like, you have got to be kidding me. Just an amazing, amazingly defiled place. People just, man, they just missed it. Just missed it completely. Now, they would make offerings to Pan and throw the dead carcasses in this cave. In 1837, there was an earthquake and the cave collapsed, so water doesn't come out of it anymore. But they used to throw animals down in the cave, and water would come out below. And if the blood was in the water, they would say, okay, Pan accepted it. And so he's accepted our offering. So the mouth of this cave, this cave right here, still to this day, is called like the jaws of the netherworld, the mouth of the netherworld, or the gate of the netherworld. Some call it the gate of Hades. This is where you threw your offerings to worship Pan. No self-respecting, good, religious Jewish boy or girl would be caught dead here. Totally impure, totally unclean. Don't even talk about the place. You cannot go there. You cannot associate with those people. You must run in the other direction. And what do we have Jesus doing? We have Jesus in this very region, looking around at all these statues, Roman statues, because that's Herod's place, so there's statues of the emperor, statues of all these different things, and then all these statues of Goat Boy, and the nymph, and all these other really weird things. And Jesus is kind of looking around and goes, so who do people say I am? Whoa, that's a loaded question. That's a really loaded question. He's standing there where Jews just would. I mean, you can imagine these young guys following Jesus going, Mama is going to kill me when she finds out where I went with Rabbi Jesus today. Who do people say I am? See, this is what's so fascinating about Jesus. And I'm going to read you this next verse. And this next verse, if you'll take this seriously, this is like the ultimate rethink. The ultimate rethink of Jesus. And so the ultimate rethink of what he's asking us to do. I mean, this, I don't care how long you've been in church or how long you haven't been in church. This, man, if you take this seriously, this changes everything. He tells Simon Peter, good job. You're picking up what God has been telling you. Verse 18, and I tell you that you are Petra. Peter, Rocky, you're a little rock. I tell you that you are Peter. You're the little rock. You're the little stone. And on this rock, Petros, big rock, are there any big rocks in Caesarea Philippi that he might be referring to? On this big rock, I will build my church. And you know what? The gates or the jaws of Hades, the netherworld, will not overcome it. Whoa. Whoa. Now, this is super loaded, all right? So let's chew on this for a second. When Jesus says, I will build my church, every time the word church is used in the New Testament, it comes from the Greek word ekklesia. Ekklesia has no spiritual significance at all. It's a word that exists before Jesus walks the earth. Ekklesia just means it's a military assembly, it's a political assembly, it's just an assembly of people. And so even later in the book of Acts, the word in Greek shows up ekklesia, but since it's obvious they're not talking about the church, it's just translated group. It's just a group of people. But we translate it in English to say church, and so that Jesus says my church. But what he's saying is, I will build my assembly of people. My ecclesia. You can find an ecclesia anywhere. But see, he qualifies it, and he says, my ecclesia, my assembly, my congregation. See, if you think of church as just a building, then you're stuck with the fact that to this day, there's no church on that rock. My ecclesia. I'm going to build my ecclesia on this rock. Jesus is calling the Edah again, the new Edah, the new holy appointed people. It's nothing new. It's what God has been trying to do. God is calling a people out from slavery to go into the world, not hide from it. My ecclesia, Jesus says, is going to be made of people who faithfully, courageously, and lovingly go into places and to people's lives just like these. My ecclesia is not only for people like this, it's made of them. Talk about freaking out his Jewish friends. What? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to call people out of the bondage they find themselves in. I am going to call people out of what's taking their life from them, what's destroying the world piece by piece. I'm going to call them to become part of the rescue operation. Jesus is at it again. And Jesus says, oh, and that gate, the gate to Hades, that big hole that people throw dead animals into to worship the beast down in the netherworld, it has no power. It has no power at all. And you know what? When the law of love takes root, it won't even have any appeal. Wow. You see, Jesus could have said, let's go down there, guys, and let's trash the place. Sickos. Peter, throw rocks. Matthew, throw your accountant's book. Let's destroy everything. Let's destroy those sick idols. Let's go. Who's good at making a picket sign? Or he could have said, you guys, let's just not even tell anybody we were here. Let's get out of here. We'll talk about it on Sunday. Or he could have said, let's just pretend like it doesn't exist. We will not make mention of that. Please don't put that in the scriptures. You will stain the scriptures. Don't even mention we came around here. He could have done any of that. He could have said, you know what? Love everybody, but not those sickos. It's too far. Got to draw the line somewhere. He could have done any of that, but he doesn't. He does what God has always done, inviting people wherever they are in love into the best life possible. Not judgmental. It's the most loving, selfless thing imaginable. On this rock, I'm going to build my church, my ecclesia, my edah. I'm at it again. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5 towards the end of your Bibles. Ephesians chapter 5. So after church services months ago, my wife and I, we left here with our kids. And we went and we had lunch somewhere. And we went to a place that was, it was obviously full of, we've just been in a church service people. I mean, the place was standing room only. And everybody seemed to be dressed really nice except for me. Everybody, I mean, it was just really obvious why this place was full on a Sunday about 12:30. It was the Sunday after church crowd. It was the brunch lunch crowd, you know, when they charge more on the menu. What's up with that? So I had some discussions with some friends of mine about the reality of Christians and how people see Christians and stuff, and I just got this idea to ask this question. And our waitress was just busting her tail. I mean, she had sweat pouring down her face. She was waiting on like 10 tables, and it was loud. And I stopped her, and I said, "Can I ask you a really strange question, and you be totally honest with me?" And she's like, "Yeah." I said, "How would you describe the Sunday after church crowd by comparison to like everybody else you serve through the week? How would you describe them?" She said, "Honestly, uh-oh." She said, and a direct quote, "They're terrible. They're horrible. They're the worst all week long." They're terrible. They're horrible. They're the worst all week long. She said, "I've been here since we opened this morning at about 10:30 to get ready for this, for these people, to get ready for this lunch crowd. I've been waiting tables all day long, and I have already been stiffed," meaning I've served a table and they didn't tip me, knowing this is part of how I pay my bills. No one wants to be working on Sunday morning. I obviously have to. I've obviously got young children at home. I've got some kind of story that I need to finance. And I've been stiffed 7 times by midway through lunch. How is that possible? How is that possible? See, someday, somebody's going to invite this girl to church. And she's going to roll her eyes and they're going to go, "Oh, no, 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 our church is different." And she's going to go, "No, it's not." Because people who, it seems to me, the people who go to church are really enthusiastic in the building, but then they walk out and they disconnect from everything that they hold dear. They don't seem to understand what's important to me. And so do you know what she thinks of Jesus? Because they're inseparable. Jesus apparently only cares about what happens early in the morning in a certain place. He doesn't seem to be concerned with real life. I love all these stats that talk about people are leaving the church. Really? You're surprised by that? Really? How did we get there? See, we're always, always, always teaching people about Jesus. And what I ran into is not a unique issue. It's pervasive. And people will look at followers of Jesus and they're learning something about Jesus by looking at his followers. And what do they think? What do they think when they look at people? Horrible? Worst ever? See, many of us grew up with this exact mindset when we look at the church, that it's an institution and that it's a building, or it's an emphasis on the building, and so that there are some associated dues, there are some associated laws, a whole bunch of yawning, and really nothing that would translate into what we would all agree is the real world. Nothing. It's not transformative. It's something we can show up to, and then something that later on that same day we can walk away from and leave it there. That's how it was for me growing up. Many of you growing up, maybe it is still for you right now. It's like this irrelevant hobby that some people take very seriously and try to convert other people to. But it's not transformative. It's not life-changing. It's not transforming the world. You know what? I think it's doing worse than that. I think it's reinforcing people's hunch about God, that he's not everywhere. He's in a building, and not just any building. It has to be a certain kind of building with a certain kind of ornamentation. God doesn't care about life out here. God cares about what happens in there. So God is in there, and so are his interests, and so are his people. But you can walk away from it. And so the emphasis becomes on where we find God in a building. And so now suddenly we've got to create something that really looks like a religion based on property. And then we tell our kids, don't run in there. Take your hat off. Why? You wear your hat in your car. Well, God's more in there than what? Where did we get that? Run in church. It's a building. I'm going to get some emails from the elders later on that one. Let me back this up just a little bit. See, listen, this sounds counterintuitive for me to be saying this. Let me be perfectly clear. This is an ancient, beautiful thing that we're doing. It has beauty, it has importance, it has significance, where we come together to challenge each other and to sing and to come into contact communally with God. That is a sacred, necessary thing. It really is. I wouldn't trade it. But what I want you to know, and some of you, you've been in the church for a while, and some of you, you won't step foot in one. Here's what I want you to rethink. If our journey of faith is an alphabet, this is not Z. I submit to you that it's not even L. I'm not trying to take away its significance and its beauty. It's just, this isn't the end game. Do you know how many people I talk to that don't want to be part of the life in Jesus because they can't disassociate the idea that they've been presented, that this is what God set up. This is all God wants. Get in here. As beautiful as it is, it's not Z. Following Jesus, you're following a Jesus that stands on that rock and says, yeah, I'm gonna go right into this place. I'll go right into the mouth of that cave and love people. I want to invite all people wherever we find them to the best life possible. Jesus, he came with a mission then, and it's the same mission now. So Jesus is still now very interested in giving people the best life possible, meeting people where they are. Jesus heals. Jesus feeds hungry. Jesus gives drink to the thirsty. Jesus embraced lepers, and so he's still doing the same with the modern equivalent of a leper. Jesus hangs out with people who have been forgotten. Jesus accepts those who have been dismissed. Jesus was number one among the prostitutes. Jesus goes into people's lives and heals and cures and listens and partners. And it doesn't matter who they are, because he brings the power of the love of God to people. He doesn't set up a community of people to be like, you be the morality police and just judge people from inside here. No, this is my edah, and I want people to join it because I want to give humanity their life back. That's what we're invited into. A beautiful movement of love that invites human beings wherever we find them. And we're constantly, constantly teaching people what Jesus is really like. Look at the Ephesians 5 passage. Be imitators of God. That word imitators, it's mimickers. The Greek means mimic. Mimic God. Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, all of us, everybody. We couldn't pay him back. He just gave himself, gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering. It's like he became incense and a sacrifice to God. Be imitators of God. That's what he's asking us to do. Be imitators of God. How do you imitate an invisible God? You got to look at the life of Jesus and do it as dearly beloved children. What's that mean? How many of you, you consider yourself a new parent? Raise your hand. I'm a newer parent. My kids are younger than 10. I'm still learning. Okay? How many of you would say that you're doing things that your parents did that it embarrasses you? Good or bad? It's starting to, I can't believe I just said that. My mom used to do that. You wash your own mouth out with soap? Do you know why you do that? Because good or bad, you were around your parents a lot. And who they are rubbed off on you. And you are a parent mimicker. As dearly beloved children, mimic the Father. How do we do that? He's invisible. Yet you watch Jesus. Look at what he cared about. Look at what broke his heart. Look at his mission. Look at what he calls his edah, his ecclesia to do. Be part of that. Jesus does these things and then he turns to us and says, now you take it further. Take it further. Go mimic this. Take it further. Go love people. You're my church. You're supposed to teach people what I'm like. Go tell people what I'm like. Go tell people what I'm interested in. You're my church. You're my body. You're my edah. Go show people what I'm like. You're not a club. Jesus turns to you and says, you're not a club. You're going to go teach people what I'm like. So I want you to ask yourself a question. What do you think church membership means? What comes to mind? Let's rethink it. What does it mean to be a member of a church? And I want to submit to us that it doesn't mean anything like country club. What it means is that when people look at us, Jesus could say, who do you say I am? They'd look at our lives and say, I'll tell you who Jesus is. He's this loving, gentle, kind, bold, courageous leader of a total revolution that transforms everything and everyone his body touches. That's who Jesus is. Tell me more. Let's pray. God, anything that we believe or that we, any filters or lenses that we've passed ideas through, anything that we have in our minds that makes you smaller and less significant than what you really are, ask God that you would destroy that. That you would just you just totally destroy it. You'd just take it out of our minds and help us to completely rethink this whole thing. Some of us, we've been in church a long time. Some of us, we don't want to be part of the church. All these wrong ideas surrounding what it is that you actually invite us into. So God, help us to understand that you invite us out of our Egypts. But it doesn't stop there. It's not just about us. You call us to be an appointed people who go into the world to represent the sender. That's what you set up. The scriptures are plain that you do that boldly. You invite us into that boldly. So this, God, this is not safe. This is not, it's easy just to tweak our schedule a little bit and feel badly about other people's misbehavior. It's hard and it's dangerous and it's life-altering to follow Jesus into every cave, into every people, and not judge them, but love them, so that when people would look at us, they'd say, that looked just like God. God, will you help us to grab a hold of a piece of that? Yeah, we're excited about what that means. We're excited about what that will do in us and through us. We're excited of what it would mean to never associate yawning with your church again. We look forward to seeing what that looks like. And we do it following Jesus. Amen. Okay, so what? Everybody run out of here and tip your waitress, right? Which I think would be great, always. But the so what factor is pretty high. What does this look like? Well, we think that it looks different regionally, wherever you go. There's all kinds of great communities that are set, and God puts unique calls on their personality and where the corner of the world they find them. we feel like we're pretty clear on what God's called us to do here. And so as we're rethinking what church membership looks like, tonight is what's the point. So in your bulletins, hang with me for 30 more seconds. In your bulletins, in your programs, at the bottom or somewhere inside, it says, what's the point? That is a program. Jonathan Bow, our lead pastor, he leads people through that. And he says, this is what it means to join this community. This is what it means to pursue Z. And this is the very clear and strategic thing that it seems like God has put on our community to do and to be. And so some of you are wondering, okay, how do I take part in this? I would suggest that you come back here at 6 o'clock tonight to find that out. Now, please don't come unannounced, because we want to provide you with a snack and some child care. And no, you can't just drop your kids off. What's the point tonight, 6 o'clock? What I want you to do is, if you're thinking about coming, on the inside flap, there's some email addresses for the staff. Third one down, Mara Gregler. What I want you to do is I want you to email her. Yeah, we'll be there. Here's how many of us there'll be. Here's how many kids, because we'll try and set up some child care for your children. So you can ask questions. You can say, well, what about this? And cool, what about that? And how do you do it? And it will give you an opportunity to join what we believe God has called us to do here uniquely at Crosspoint. That's what we want to offer you to do. So if I don't see you, we'll see you next Sunday. Hopefully we'll see you tonight. Have a great week.